This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
The problem that we're facing right now is to make a determination as to what's called core duties. And what that means is, what are the things that a president has to do their job? Actions related to their core duties as president are now off limits.
That's defense attorney Jack Rice on the landmark ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court deciding on whether former President Trump is entitled to some immunities. Details coming up also. Coordinated suicide bombings killed 18 people and wounded 19 in Nigeria. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. In our top story, in a historic case, the Supreme Court ruled today that former presidents are entitled to immunity from prosecution for official actions, but not private conduct. The decision comes in response to a case related to former President Donald Trump's claims of blanket immunity in a federal election subversion case. Jack Rice, an award-winning criminal defense lawyer and former prosecutor and U.S. Central Intelligence Agency officer, tells VOA's Carol Van Dam what this case is about and what happens next.
This is an extraordinary case because we've never seen anything like it. We have never had a situation where there was a question of whether or not a sitting president or even a former president has immunity from prosecution and whether or not any prosecution can move forward as a result. In other words, the possibility is that a president could do literally anything or nothing that could result in a prosecution and whether it could simply be stopped. This idea that the president said, I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue. Is that actually something he could have immunity from? That's the question that runs all the way in the gamut between those various sort of polar opposites. That's where we sit. That's what the Supreme Court was actually addressing in a very big picture.
If you just take that example, like say that not just the threat, but if somebody committed murder, whether you're the president or not, I mean, come on, that's got to be actionable in a court of law, right?
Well, see, it's an obvious question, but what happened was they got pushback on that at the Court of Appeals, and even his own team had to finally acknowledge that that wasn't the case. But that wasn't actually their basic starting point. Their argument was, as the president of the United States, you have full and complete immunity from anything and everything that you do, full stop. Now, contemplate what that means. That the fundamental question that we have in this case is this: is the president above the law? And that's actually where we stand. Now, what we found in this case is that Chief Justice Roberts actually came down and said, and I quote, the president is not above the law. So that in itself says something fundamental about where we are. Believe it or not, that in itself is significant because we have never had a decision in the history of the United States on whether that was actually the case or not. So now we at least know that there are some limits. The real question now will be, what is actionable? What is it that it allows the president to have immunity, and what could he potentially, he or she, in the future, face criminally if so charged?
It still leads to the question of what determines what is an official act as opposed to just doing something in your private life. How do you determine that? Is it gray still?
It's still gray. The problem that we're facing right now is to make a determination as to what's called core duties. And what that means is, what are the things that a president has to do their job? Actions related to their core duties as president are now off limits. In other words, if there's something fundamental to being the president, what is it that the president does and must do? You cannot prosecute somebody for the things they do within the context of that. Anything that happens outside of the context of that is potentially prosecutable. The problem is even that is extraordinarily difficult to determine, because what happens if somebody acts criminally inside of their core duties. What happens if somebody who is the president of the United States says, go and shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue as president when you call the vice president, or if you call somebody at the Department of Justice? Is that actionable? Can they be prosecuted? The problem is it's very unclear completely what the distinctions are for core duties and non-core duties.
This goes back to the lower court ruling. What does that mean in immediate terms for this very political year?
What this means is we're going to see another delay. This is going to go back to the U.S. District Court. The U.S. District Court now has to make a determination as to what things are core values and what things are not in this current criminal prosecution. So in other words, the district court judge is going to literally have to look at the complaint again, as will the Department of Justice, and then say, we can't go after this, we can't go after this, because that was a core value.
That was Jack Rice, an award-winning criminal defense lawyer and former prosecutor, speaking with VOA's Carol Van Dam. U.S. presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump are back on the campaign trail following their first debate last week. Biden's sometimes struggling performance in that debate has some members of his political party looking at who might replace him as their nominee. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has the story.
Donald Trump and Joe Biden were back on the campaign trail after last week's first debate, with Biden looking to reassure supporters that he's ready for a second term following an at times halting debate performance.
I give you my word as a Biden, I would not be running again if I didn't believe with all my heart and soul I can do this job. Because quite frankly, the stakes are too high.
Biden fundraising over the weekend was another chance for his campaign to push back against concern among some in the Democratic Party that his debate stumbles mean they should be looking for a new candidate. University of Virginia Center for Politics Director Larry Sabato.
If there were a new, vigorous, younger Democratic nominee, I think people would take that opportunity in a minute to keep Trump out.
Trump said the debate showed this election is a choice between strength and weakness.
The question every voter should be asking themselves today is not whether Joe Biden can survive a 90-minute debate performance, but whether America can survive four more years of crooked Joe Biden in the White House.
Trump told a post-debate rally that he believes Biden will stay in the race.
Many people are saying that after last night's performance that Joe Biden is leaving the race. But the fact is, I don't really believe that, because he does better in polls than any of the Democrats they're talking about.
Among the Democrats who some in their party are talking about possibly replacing Biden are his running mate, Vice President Kamala Harris, Governor of the key swing state of Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, California Governor Gavin Newsom, Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, and Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker. None of those Democrats is calling for replacing Biden. Switching candidates before their party's August convention would require Biden dropping out. Again, Larry Sabato.
They would have to go to the White House and try to convince him, and he will be tough to convince. And they'll also have to try to convince Joe Biden, and that may be even tougher.
The First Lady told a post-debate rally that her husband showed he's America's best choice.
What you saw last night on the debate stage was Joe Biden, a president with integrity and character. Who told the truth? And Donald Trump told lie after lie after lie.
Early post-debate polling by CBS News shows most Democrats believe Biden should still be their nominee. It's the political party's conventions that will have greater impacts with voters than debates, says Marquette University political science professor Julia Azari.
The sort of state-of-the-art research in political science about what sorts of events seem to drive vote intent and become increasingly sort of predictive of how people will vote in November, the conventions matter, but debates don't.
The Biden campaign held a post-debate conference call with Democratic National Committee members about the coming convention. Some committee members on the call told the Associated Press that it was an overly rosy assessment of Biden's path to re-election and largely ignored criticism of his debate performance. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Coordinated suicide bombings killed 18 people and wounded 19 in Nigeria's Borno state on Saturday in the latest attacks to shake public confidence in security. Security officials say women allegedly carried the bombs into a wedding and a hospital. President Bola Tinubu condemned the attacks and vowed that the perpetrators will not go unpunished. Dr. Muhammad Sani Abubakar is a lecturer in the Department of Military Studies at the University of Abuja. He's also a certified anti-terrorism specialist and expert on the Lake Chad region. Abubakar told reporter Mike Mbonye in Lagos, it appears that the women bombers were deceived into carrying the explosives.
I believe what happened in Borno, in Gozo, is a very unfortunate situation. But I don't think the perpetrators, you know, were coerced into it. I think they were innocent locals who were deceived, you know, to go into this, and they might not even know that this is what, you know, they were doing. You understand? I suppose they were just asked to take this item or this vessel or this package, go there and drop it, and the mastermind now detonated, maybe with their phones or something. You know, because the IDPs are on a very different axis from Gozo. I don't see any correlation with that.
Do you also think that the recent bombings is a sign of restarting of hostilities in Borno State, given the recent statement by the Nigerian Defense Headquarters on the degrading of terrorists in the country?
You're right. This suicide bombing in Gozo is a clear indication that the hostilities is coming back. You might not even know. Two soldiers and I think an aid worker were kidnapped just 2 weeks ago, I think somewhere in Monguno. As I'm talking to you, a judge, his wife, who is a magistrate court judge, his police orderly, a driver, were also kidnapped, I think, between Biu and Jamatru. All these are indication that this terrorism, this act of sabotage by Boko Haram, is getting reinvigorated. And I think it's because the military, as well as the other sister security agencies, you know, are relapsing. Understand? They are not being proactive as they used to be. And the state government also has a role to play in providing social amenities, opportunities for job, promises made to repentant IDPs to be fulfilled. All these things are things that will help, you know, in the non-kinetic aspect of counterinsurgency.
That was Mohammed Sani Abubakar, an anti-terrorism expert, speaking by phone with reporter Mike Mbonye from Maiduguri, northeast Nigeria. You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. And for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs, and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. With 99% of the votes counted by Sunday afternoon, Mauritania's National Election Commission forecasts that President Mohamed Ould Cheikh El Ghazouani will garner more than 56% of votes cast, enough to win a second five-year term, with rival and human rights activist Biram Dal Abdi predicted to win 22%. Abid said he will not recognize the result, saying, "Ghazouani controls the election commission." He said his supporters will take to the streets in a peaceful protest. Mauritanians voted Saturday to choose among seven candidates vying to lead the nation. The Electoral Commission still has to confirm the provisional results before they are sent to the Constitutional Council for final validation. After weeks of political maneuvering, South Africa now has a cabinet after one of the most contested elections in the nation's history. The African National Congress had to form a unity government after it got just 40% of the vote in the election on May 29th, losing the majority it held since South Africa's first democratic election in 1994. Darren Taylor reports.
President Cyril Ramaphosa has appointed 32 cabinet ministers and 43 deputy ministers to accommodate the 11 parties that comprise South Africa's new coalition government.
There has been dishing out of patronage. This cabinet will cost billions to operate, and we as South Africans understand that we don't have that kind of money or the luxury of that kind of size cabinet in a country that's relatively small.
Athol Trollope, a member of the opposition Action SA party, is like many South Africans who are concerned governance will be chaotic, with too many people making decisions and setting policy. The new cabinet must address rampant crime, soaring unemployment, infrastructure decay, corruption, electricity blackouts, and water shortages. In a speech to the nation Sunday night, Ramaphosa confirmed his African National Congress had given several key ministries to the next biggest party, the Democratic Alliance.
All the parties have made a commitment to respect the Constitution and to promote accountable and transparent governance, evidence-based policies and decision-making, the professionalization of our public service based on integrity and good governance. The incoming government will prioritize rapid, inclusive, and sustainable economic growth and the creation of a more just society by tackling poverty and inequality, as well as unemployment.
The DA considers Ramaphosa's commitment to professionalizing the public service to be a major win. In the past, it has accused the ANC of giving management positions at state-owned enterprises to party loyalists instead of to people with the proper skills. DA leader John Steenhuisen said his party's six cabinet ministers and six deputy ministers mean it has meaningful influence to set the economy on a path of recovery.
In the economics cluster, the DA will use our influential cabinet seats in agriculture, public works and infrastructure, forestry, fisheries and the environment, as well as our deputy minister roles in finance, trade and industry, and small business development to pursue a rapid growth and job creation agenda for the country.
In Ramaphosa's new cabinet, the DA also controls basic education, communications, and home affairs. Steenhuisen said the DA has watchdog deputy ministers in important sectors, including energy and electricity, water and higher education. The DA, however, doesn't have any positions in security departments, which could set the scene for conflict with the ANC. Ramaphosa also gave top posts to smaller opposition parties that are members of the governing coalition. Two of the most significant appointments are Patriotic Alliance leader Gayton McKenzie as Minister of Sports, Arts and Culture, and Freedom Front Plus leader Pieter Groenewald to oversee prisons. With so many parties involved in governance, political analyst Dr. Nsikelelo Breakfast says there's bound to be confusion.
Where does policy come from? Does it come from political parties? Does it come from bureaucracy? Because each and every political party normally holds conferences where it adopts policies. So what do? Do you cut and paste those policies?
The ANC still controls foreign policy, with a DA bitterly opposed to its close relations with China, Iran and Russia. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Time now for our sports segment. We have in studio our sports analyst, Mokbil Yabaro. Welcome to African News Tonight, Mokbil.
Thanks for having me, Yehaze.
So, UEFA Euro 2024 and Copa America 2024 have given us some amazing football over the weekend. I saw a couple. What were some of the highlights?
Yeah, so if we're just going to go over the past weekend, I would say the game that we're going to definitely talk about will have to be England versus Slovakia. Huge implications in that game. It was one of the most entertaining games thus far in the round of 16. But firstly, Switzerland versus Italy. Switzerland were able to beat the defending Euro champions, Italy, 2-0 to knock them out in the round of 16. I wouldn't say that's necessarily an upset, but I'm sure the Italian fans were not excited to be out that early. Germany was able to knock out Denmark by beating them 2-0 in a comfortable win. So the hometown, because the games are being played in Germany, the hometown favorites right now still are on pace to potentially win the tournament. And Spain came out really slinging and were able to beat Georgia 4-1. Some of the youngest players in the tournament have been very impactful in this team so far. Yamin Lamal, still 16 years old, doing his class homework after the games are done, and still assisting and doing some phenomenal things. Yes. Now, as for that England and Slovakia game, Slovakia led the game for up until the 95th minute, and until England was able to equalize and then go into extra time and then win. But what a phenomenal equalizing goal it was by Jude Bellingham. Looks like to be the face of English football at the moment with a bicycle kick. Yeah, phenomenal work from him so far. So Euro has been exciting.
Yes, it has. And the U.S. Olympic trials have been extremely competitive and exciting as well. Can you update us on the Road to Paris 2024?
Yes, Road to Paris has been very, very exciting for some of the big names that we have, especially on the U.S. side. If we're just looking at the trials, you have Noah Lyles, the reigning 100-meter world champion for the men's side, and the reigning 100-meter world champion for the women's side, Sha'Carri Richardson, who both were triumphant in their 100 meters to secure their respective spaces for the Paris 2024. Now, Noah Lyles also went on to break a 28-year record by Michael Johnson in the 200-meter Olympic trials, where he was able to come from behind and catch up and beat Kenny Bednarik, who has been running phenomenally as well. But you know how difficult it is to come off of a turn and have to chase down somebody who is arguably one of the fastest as well in that race. So shout out to Noah Lyles for being able to not only make the 100-meter men race, but also lock in for that 200 meters as well.
And lastly, Mokbil, in the NBA offseason, some key players have been traded. What has been confirmed so far?
The biggest one that we have seen right now that kind of sent a shock through the NBA world is Paul George leaving his LA Clippers team with Kawhi Leonard and Russell Westbrook and James Harden. That core that they created that kind of gained some momentum towards the end of last season, he is leaving them and he is going to the Philadelphia 76ers. He will be joining the young man Tyrese Maxey, as well as the former last year's reigning MVP Joel Embiid, Cameroonian. So it'll be exciting to see what this new quote-unquote big three will be able to do. As we all know, Paul George is a phenomenal player, just has had some health issues. But if he's able to stay healthy, I'm excited to see what they're able to do in the East.
VOA sports analyst Mokbil Yabaro, as usual, thank you for your input.
Thanks for having me.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Adrius Rigas, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.